Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit 1 per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
A rare dedication. 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon. This episode goes out to Bo. You don't know Bo, but Bo is my flooring guy. He put it all in one day, and that allows us to record without banging and crashing today. So, Bo, thank you, and it looks great.
Do you get free flooring for this big
plug? No, I've already paid. So nothing comes out of this, but the fact that we're doing this without banging and crashing and all that kind of stuff is amazing. So, Bo, thank you. He's a big hockey guy.
So would Lala set you up with him? Or?
No, he does know Gary. But, funny story, though. Bo and I connected, and he said, I know a couple of guys that you've played the men's league with. They say you chirp a lot. I'm like, yeah. That's legit. Yeah.
So did you chirp Bo while he's doing the floor?
No.
Stayed out of the way, did you?
I barricaded the dogs in the back because we had a new puppy. We had to control everybody, and it's all good. And we have an Australian Shepherd. What are you getting? You're getting a new dog.
By the way, when I thought you said shout out to Bo, I thought you were talking about your new dog.
Bear Bed. It's got two names because we couldn't agree on it in the household.
What?
We have, seriously? I know. It's got a legal name and a nickname.
Oh, okay. All right.
Just like two Johns today with John Shannon and John Collins. I bet you he's got some dirt on you from your time together at the league.
I don't think so. I think it was a calm, cool relationship.
No, John was a great guy. Got to know him when you guys were together in the National Hockey League.
Yeah.
And I'm legitimately interested to see the difference between working at the National Hockey League and working at the club level, because you know as well as anybody, you're on one side for a long time. You think, why can't they be more flexible? Why can't they do this? And then you go over there and you go, that's why.
The concept of when you're at the league, you worry about 1,312 games. And when you're at a team, you worry about 82. it's hyper-focused.
And the 82 are more important than the 1,300, arguably.
Well, you hyper-focus on the 82. And it is a totally different animal. It is a totally different animal. But John was good to work with. And he came in. I was there before he was, but he came in from his time at the NFL and with the Cleveland Browns. And it was probably the wise thing to bring somebody from the outside the hockey sphere, to create growth. And that's what John did. You know, he was a big part of outdoor games. He was a big part of the original Rogers 12-year deal in Canada. Yeah, John's had a lot of influence, even in 2025, on the game as a whole, as opposed to being one of the co-owners and operating the New York Islanders.
And that's a franchise that's gone through a real journey over the last 15 years.
Tumultuous journey. You know, three arenas, ownership changes, in a market. I mean, the NBA doesn't have three teams in New York. The National Football League doesn't have three teams in New York. Neither does Major League Baseball. Hockey has three teams, and that has to be a huge challenge.
great rink. They're set up well. We'll get his take on UBS Arena as we get into it. John Collins standing by. Just joined the green room. So let's slide over there with 100% Hockey, Millard and Shannon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Show continues with the operating partner and co-owner of the New York Islanders. Here's John Collins. What's this journey been like for you joining the New York Islanders? Then we'll get into the more current situation with the hockey club.
I mean, it's kind of been coming back to my roots a little bit. I grew up in New York. I was going to college on Long Island during the Islanders, obviously, dynasty. So you couldn't avoid that. And then obviously my path took me, you know, I worked in the city, you know, took me through the advertising world, to the NFL, NFL films, a lot of years at the NFL. And then I started writing John's coattails at the NHL.
Oh, please.
And did a couple of things when I left the NHL, did a private equity gig and then did an investment gig. And really it was in Florida. And when Scott Malkin, who's the principal owner, you know, sort of called and said, it really kind of out of the blue. I mean, I knew Scott a little bit along with John when they were purchasing the club from Charles Wong. And they had like a 2-year period where they were sort of, you know, observing, but Charles was still in control. And during that time, whenever Scott, who lives in London, whenever Scott would come in to sort of see the commissioner, he would give me a ring and say, hey, how about a coffee or a Coke? He drinks Diet Coke. And we'd go downstairs and we would chat. And I have to say, like, Scott is a very unique person, individual. I said to him at one point, I said, look, the questions that you ask are not like any owner NFL, NHL have ever asked me. Like, you want to talk about brand, you want to talk about marketing, you want to talk about the globalization of the sport. And so we kind of hit it off, but I left the NHL before he and John took 100% ownership from Charles. And I love my time at the NHL. I spent a lot of time with John Shannon, got yelled at a lot by John Shannon, but
that is not true. So now you're spreading like urban myths again.
It is true.
There's a big club in that group.
I know. He's told a lot of people to get off.
Yeah.
I was living in Florida and Scott said, hey, look, why don't you come up and take a, you know, here you still have family here. I hear you still come up to New York quite a bit. Next time you're up, why don't you come see what we've built since you've been gone, which was UBS Arena. And so I went to UBS Arena and I don't know if you guys have had a chance to get there yet, but it's magnificent. I mean, Scott's family business is real estate development, Empire State Building. He's got his own business, which is really these luxury retail shopping villages throughout Europe and in China. So he really has that eye about creating, you know, sort of these landmark sort of entities, buildings, villages, everything else. So it was beautiful. And then I was on the board for the company that we took public, Supergroup, which was a sports gaming company. They were based in London. And so, you know, maybe the next month I go to London for a board meeting and I happen to call Scott and said, hey, I'm in town. How about another Diet Coke? And he sent me to Bicester Village, which was his first sort of shopping village that he had built. And it's sort of the anchor of everything else that he's done. 9 shopping villages, 2 hotels, the arena. And when I got there, I'm not much of a shopper, as you can tell. John can verify that. I'm not really a fashionista, but I got there and I was touring the village. And almost the second I got in there, I was like, I get it. These people think that they actually work for Disney, you know, or Universal Studios or something. They were so in tune with the guest experience and how to really enhance it. So that was a little different. And then as I got toured around by the GM, I asked, it was like a Tuesday. The holiday lights were on the ground, but they hadn't yet been put up. So it was getting close to holiday season, but it was not the beginning of the holiday season yet. And I just sort of casually said, I said, how many people would you have here today? And she said, I don't know, maybe 30,000, 35,000. And I was like, wow, that's pretty good. And I said, what did you have over the weekend? And she said, well, we had 55,000 on Saturday and 50,000 on Sunday. And then sort of the light went off and I was like, I got it. You know, this is like, we had talked a lot about this at the NFL, but it was the, you know, that Venn diagram of, you know, sort of sports, entertainment, fashion, all kind of coming together and overlapping. And that really was what Scott is building out at Belmont Park. You know, so you got the arena there, which is phenomenal. Belmont Park Raceway, which will host the, you know, the Belmont Stakes and the Breeders' Cup, has got a $450 million renovation. So that's going to open up in probably September of 26. And it'll be amazing. It'll be the best, you know, horse racing facility in North America, if not the world. And then you've got Scott's Belmont Park Village with 155 retail shops anchored by all the big fashion brands, 6 restaurants, and projected to draw between 6 and 8 million people a year to that campus. And so, and we've talked to Belmont Park about music festivals, you know, when they go up to Saratoga in the summer on the racetrack, they obviously, John, want to figure out a way to get a Winter Classic there. We said, we'll work with them. So it's, you know, to me, it was like this crazy convergence of all these things that, you know, I was doing or trying to do in my career. And then it was basically back in New York where I grew up. And so it was kind of one of those things like, why wouldn't I do this? You know, given the opportunity, why wouldn't I do it? And so we just figured out a way that made sense for Scott and made sense for me, which ultimately was me making an investment in the club and sort of joining him as a, you know, sort of a partner on the business.
Do you have to convince people inside the Islander organization that a bigger strategy is really important to what's going on?
No, because I was kind of the newcomer, right? Scott and his value retail guys and the collection of, you know, artists and designers and real estate people that he's built over 30 years, you know, they were there at the arena from day one, right? They were the guys who worked with Populous and worked with OVG, who's our 50-50 partner in the arena. And so that was kind of, that sensibility was infused right away. And then, as you guys know, the Islander franchise has had a bunch of twists and turns. And so when Scott took the club, it was literally Charles Wong had sold the business to Barclays, right? And so they were making a guarantee for all the gate receipts and all the sponsorship and everything. They basically took over the business and gave Charles a guarantee, which was a good deal for Charles because, you know, he got a multiple on those revenues, which I don't think are as high revenues as he was generating in Nassau Coliseum. And so when the decision was made that Barclays wasn't going to be the right long-term home, and there was an opportunity with Governor Cuomo at the time to do something unique in Belmont Park, they literally had to hire a whole new business staff, right? So they were sort of like an expansion franchise, but, you know, in a market that already, you know, had, you know, a lot of success and had a, great franchise, dynastic franchise. And then OVG, you know, John, it was also, I think this was the first, it might've been 1A or 1B in the development of Oakview Group, right? So right. They were building UBS Arena at the same time as they were building or remodeling Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle. So it was really important for Tim and Irving and you know, it's New York, right? So it gets a lot of attention. So I think the story was pretty well understood that, you know, Scott and John were trying to do something different and unique, you know, with this franchise and this building.
Did you have an opinion on the Barclays situation and that era at the time?
You know, I was at the league. So I went to a couple of games. I think I went to a game. I remember going to a game with David Blitzer, who had just, you know, along with Josh Harris, bought the Devils. And we went to a game just because, I don't know, maybe the Devils were playing the Islanders. What I remember about, again, it's David Blitzer. He's a part owner in New Jersey Devils. And I remember the seats that we were sitting in, you know, if the game was here, our seats That's were facing right. over here, you know, That's and I was right. just like, we kind of like scratching our heads going like, this obviously isn't going to work, you know? So I thought it was, I thought it was an interesting, it was unfortunate that Charles was never able to get that Lighthouse project approved and underway. I think he really tried and spent a lot of money and a lot of time to try to make that happen. I don't understand the politics that didn't allow it to happen. So I thought the Barclays thing was a interesting, opportunistic way to perhaps resolve, you know, and there wasn't a lot of chatter, but, you know, the potential chatter of, you know, could the team afford to stay on Long Island, right? Mm-hmm. And in New York, you know, should they be, if they were sold, would they be sold to someone else? And so that was a pretty creative way of doing it. And by the way, Barclays, John was there too. I mean, Barclays launched with a lot of fanfare, right? It was a big project. They had 10 nights of Jay-Z to open up the building. You know, the Brett Yormark, who was the CEO at the time, took out like a full building across the street from Madison Square Garden, which was like the Brooklyn Nets, you know, here we are, kind of, you know, which infuriated the Knicks. And I mean, it was kind of a fun time. It was an interesting time. But I think long term, this is clearly the better solution for the franchise. And I think in terms of you think about franchise values and what ultimately that Belmont Park campus is going to be able to provide New York, Metro New York, including Long Island, it'll be amazing.
You know, the Brooklyn experiment was one where I think it really was a slap in the face to the long-term Islander fans, the guys that truly believe they're Long Islanders rather than New Yorkers. Is there a way to define what an Islander fan is? And particularly for people outside of the tri-state area who might understand it, but the rest of North America trying to figure out what an Islander fan is?
Yeah. I mean, you're right about that, by the way. I lived on Long Island during those years at the league. And so if I was coming to Barclays from the city, it was a piece of cake. But if I drove in on a Saturday, it was, forget it. Look, I mean, the Islander fan, you know, it's a Metro New York team, right? But it's kind of the blue collar family working class brand, right? Which is Long Island. I mean, there is an enormous amount of wealth out here. But it tends not to be the corporate wealth that you would see in New York or Toronto, right? It's the guy who started his own HVAC company, you know, and then sold it, you know, and is doing really quite well, but probably still lives in the same neighborhood that he was born in or that he raised his family. So there's a lot of disposable wealth. I think there's a lot of pride that goes into that, you know, gritty, working class persona. Obviously the dynasty years were still such an important part. It's almost like the tattoo that you proudly wear You know, it has such an important part of that identity. And I think that, again, I wasn't here. But the early days of the new ownership, the Scott Malkin, John Ledecky ownership, which, you know, brought Lou Lamoriello and Barry Trotz to Long Island. I mean, I think that was sort of the instant credibility. Those guys gave the Islanders instant credibility in terms of this was going to be an ownership group that was going to pursue excellence and championships. And that's really what it's all about, right? I mean, you want to create a great fan experience and all that, but at the end of the day, you know, you want to be competitive consistently.
So that's a good question. How do you balance that? How do you create that balance between, gosh, we just like going to the games and having a good time for our family, but we may not win as much as we can or have. What becomes that conversation inside the office? Because a lot of, you know, like here in Toronto, I mean, and I worked for a guy named Richard Petty. It was all the Maple Leafs are the Maple Leafs are the engine. The Maple Leafs are the engine. That was his favorite phrase. Is it the same in a place that's rediscovering itself like the Island?
I don't think so, because I think the Islanders, you know, look, it's New York. You have four arenas. You have three hockey teams, right? You got two baseball teams. You got two football teams. You got two basketball teams. You need to win, right? People. And by the way, we compete. The Islanders compete with the Rangers in their backyard, in our backyard, right? So it's not, you know, I have family members who are Ranger fans, and you know, I mean, houses that are split between Rangers and that. So you have to fight for that all the time. I think that what Scott and John have put in place is a world class experience, which will only get better, right? As you bring in the game press guys and you figure out how to really program, you put the software into the hardware, it'll only get better. But there's no doubt that the connection with the team and with the players and ultimately with a competitive, you know, competitive product on the ice consistently is the only thing that really is going to cut through this incredibly competitive entertainment landscape here in New York. I mean, it's the same everywhere else, but it is in New York. And so I think that's the, you know, that's first and foremost is the vision of, you know, ultimately Scott and the ownership group, which is, you know, we're going to spend to the cap. You know, we're going to give hockey every resource that they say they need to make sure. And we're going to create sort of the best environment for the players, both at the practice facility as well as, you know, at the arena to do what they need to do. And ideally, while we're doing that, we'll create a fan experience that will be second to none. And ultimately, we'll have people feeling like, you know, this is their home, right? UBS Arena is their home. You know, they had again, I wasn't there. They had the two Eastern Conference finals in that first 2 years, I guess, of Lou and Barry. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that wasn't in UBS Arena. So UBS Arena hasn't had that christening moment, you know, of a deep run in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Hopefully that's coming soon.
Continue our conversation as we get more hockey focused with John Collins from the New York Islanders on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I love UBS Arena, and I've got a couple of favorite parts, but you're there almost every day. What's your favorite attribute to this new rink?
You know, there's something for everyone, right? So, I mean, we've got all the bells and whistles that any major arena in a major market would have to So, you know, from a, you can spend whatever you want to spend in terms of the experience, but there's something for everyone. I think the thing that I constantly am taken back by is the thought that went into it. There is, you know, there are so many little, like, for example, we had two nights of Drake. I think it was like, maybe it was the end of the last summer. And he had gone through New York. So this was the second time through New York. On that first run, he didn't play UBS Arena. So he was coming back to New York and playing UBS Arena. Maybe it was a favor to Tim Leiwicki at the time, you know. He ended up, and we had a guy, Ricky Kirshner, who is kind of a legendary music producer. His father was Don Kirshner.
Remember the old Kirshner, Don Kirshner? Friday Night Rock. What is it? Don Kirshner's
exactly.
Rock. NBC.
So Ricky, so his son is a, you know, Ricky produced the Super Bowl halftime for 12 years, right? So I knew Ricky. Anyway, it's Drake. I have three boys, you know, 21 to 28. They wanted to go to see Drake. It was a big deal. Ricky calls for tickets to go see Drake because his daughter is basically working directly for Drake, and her job is to sort of set up, make sure, like, for his game day, he's got everything he needs so that he can be unburdened. And we meet her down in the loading dock, and she goes on to say that basically Drake liked the whole facility, the guest, you know, the artist sort of compound so much that she ended up setting up Drake's apartment in the building. And he would go out, you know, wherever, New York City, whatever. He would come back into the arena at like whatever time he got back. And he had an apartment in the green rooms that were built you know, in the arena. And he basically used it as an apartment. And then he would get up at, you know, 2-3 o'clock. He'd do his rehearsal. Then he'd go back in and use the cold plunge and do a workout and, you know, have a meal. And so that's the thing about UBS Arena. It was built with real purpose. I think the line that I heard was, you know, sort of built for hockey, made for music. And, you know, Tim Leiwicki and Irving Azoff, who obviously were the founders of Oakview, they took the music part of it very seriously, right? They wanted to make sure that you're competing with the Garden, you're competing with Barclays, even Prudential. You know, that when an artist came, it was a great experience for them. It was easy to get in and out. So from a cost standpoint, compared to, you know, doing something at one of the other arenas, it was really efficient. So in theory, you could make more money by booking shows at UBS, but then you can be certain that your fan base is going to have like an unbelievable experience. So the show, the arena opened up with Harry Styles, who was on his global tour, obviously a Azoff client. And he did, you know, one show at UBS to kind of open it up. He ended up doing four shows, I think, in the area, maybe at the Garden. But that first show, that was the show that was recorded and streamed live because the acoustics in the building and the production compound were so good that it was almost like a sound studio for the Styles performance. So that's the thing that amazes me. And then obviously, Lou came in, you know, as the building was getting built, it wasn't finished. So I think the structure was there, but the inside wasn't. And you can be certain that Lou spared no expense in terms of building out the hockey portion of it. I mean, the facility inside for the players, for the trainers, for the coaches, you know, for the hockey ops staff is second to none.
How difficult was it to see Lou leave?
You know, it was really, look, it's still, I considered it to be a failing on my part, to be honest. I mean, not that I had that much influence on it, but, you know, I think I had really grown, working with Lou was really one of the big appealing parts of the job, right? Like I bought into Scott, I bought into the vision for the arena, and then Lou was there. And I overlapped with Lou, obviously, during my time. He was on the executive committee when I got to the NHL. I got yelled at by Lou, just like I got yelled at by Shannon. You know, working with him, you know, I grew up like you guys. You know, I grew up loving sports, playing sports. But, you know, I also started my career with NFL Films, which made sort of their admiration for the and love and passion for the game like the center product. And so that old Teddy Roosevelt line about it's all about the folks in the arena, right?
Right.
I grew up with that. And, you know, I went to St. Francis Prep. That's where Vince Lombardi, you know, went to high school, you know, played football. So, like, from an early age, that was, I loved it, right? I loved the old Green Bay Packers. I loved reading about, you know, Scotty Bowman and the Canadian. Like, I just loved that part of sports. And so my time with Lou was almost like, it was like a master's class in the mentality about how to compete and what you need to do. And I learned, you know, more so than I did at the league, that, you know, Lou has a very unique way, as everybody knows, he has a very unique way of looking at things. He runs the show. He's been running the show, you know, for a long time, the way that he wants to run the show without, you know, without intrusion or distractions. But he was very thoughtful about every single decision, right? It wasn't arbitrary, right? So if you know, the marketing guy would come in and say, hey, what about this? And you go, no, we're not doing that. But it wasn't, no, we're not doing it. It was specific to why he felt that that would distract from the competitive environment that he was looking to create. So it was phenomenal. I wish I was smart enough to figure out another transition that I could have recommended, you know, to the group to make it go easier. But then again, you know, that's what sports is kind of all about, right? Like, you, especially in those gigs, you kind of, it just has to, sometimes you just need change. And I think that's what happened here. Having said that, I think we got a great leader in Matthew Darche, who really, listen, the conversation around Matthew was really just about, could a first time GM, did he have the management and administrative chops to do the gig, right? Like, he clearly knew hockey. He clearly had great training. He clearly was in a great environment in Tampa. He clearly paid his dues. He was smart. He was a great communicator. He did broadcasting like you guys. So he had all those check the box. But, you know, putting him in the seat as like the CEO of hockey, you know, could he handle it? And I think he's, you know, ultimately he's going to have to win, right? But we haven't played any games yet. But he's had a phenomenal offseason. I mean, he really has made some, I think, great moves. He's unified the building, which, you know, is tough, right? With a very loyal and a very disciplined group under Lou. He's kept a lot of the people, and now, you know, they're part of Matthew's team. And I think he's, you know, he's unified the coaching staff. So, you know, Patrick Waugh and the new coaching staff there, he's put a focus on Bridgeport, which, you know, was maybe an Achilles heel for the franchise the last couple of years. And now, you know, in one offseason, I think is a pretty good, you know, development farm system. So I think he's made all the right moves, and we're really happy. And I think he's really connected with the fan base. I think the fan base likes him. He's a likable guy. He's a great communicator, and he's pretty straightforward with that group, right? So,
from a marketing standpoint, how different will the organization be post Lou? Because he was set in his ways, and I'm curious, from off the ice, how much more freedom do you have?
Look, I don't know that. I would say Lou. You know, Lou was holding anything back. I think it's just kind of, it's a new CEO, new leadership change, and it's going to reflect the new leadership, right? So I think that'll be good. Look, I can tell you because I've spoken to a lot of them, and I've heard from a lot of them. I mean, they like the environment playing for Lillard, the players, mm-hmm. right? Oh, yeah. They enjoy it. They always do, right, John? Like they always do. Yeah. And they like the environment now, right? And it's early days, right? They haven't gone through training camp, right? We haven't had a season yet, but they're okay with this too, right? So it's just different. From a fan standpoint, I think it'll be much more, we'll be much more aggressive than we have been. And my confidence in Matthew and the coach and Matthew's staff is sort of clearly saying this is the line, right? Like there are going to be things that Matthew's and has said, we're not doing that, right? We're not doing it yet. We're not doing it now, or we're not doing it at all. But I think that getting to know the players, letting the players be stars in the New York market, letting them to connect, a lot of them live on Long Island, which is really a cool thing. So when you talk about how do you really differentiate yourself? Well, the guys that are here, they play, they're here. They've been playing golf, all summer, and they're in the restaurants, and they're part of the community. They have a lot of kids, they're in the community, and that's really, really important for the Islander franchise overall, right? To be very approachable. The Rangers are the Rangers. They've got that corporate base. Hatzepetros could schedule every game, Sunday evening at 7 o'clock, and they'd be sold out, right? We need to work a little harder, right? And that's what we're going to do.
So I'm curious. You have made allegations about your time at the league with me, but which aren't, none of them are true. You're now, and you used to sit in the board meetings and talk to the teams. Now you're sitting at the same table being talked to. Tell us the difference, and tell us what you have learned in this time as being a member club, as opposed to being working from Hudson Yards.
I did kind of a similar thing with the Browns, right? When I was at the NFL for, I had two tours of duty with the league.
I was
office.
Trying not to bring the Browns up because, it's kind of that dark hole in your resume, you don't want to.
But you know what? Those are tough. As you know, you're not usually criticized at the league office. You're not usually on the hot seat, right? But you are all the time at the clubs, right? And so for me, it was, Cleveland was a great experience. I was a much, when I came back from Cleveland, I was a better executive than before I went through it. And that was really kind of maybe where Gary and I bonded, right? And because he was, he was ready to see the NHL sort of take off as a business. And he had felt like the labor piece and then sort of the revenue sharing and the rules of the game, all that stuff was kind of set up for the league to take off. And, I was, and that was appealing, right, to me. So I think any league executive really should spend time with the club, because that's the connection with the game. That is the game. That's the product. That's where all the fan passion connects, right? Nobody ever roots for the NHL shield or the NFL shield, right? So that's where it all sits. And it just made me a lot better as an executive when I went back into the league from having gotten my ass fried in Cleveland. Hopefully I just am a little older now and maybe a little smarter, and I'm not really on the front lines here. This is, I'm just one of a couple of guys in the group that offer their points of view. But I think it's critical. It's critical to have the club experience.
Well, to walk in there though and see so many familiar faces would have helped a bit, right?
Yeah, look, it was crazy. It was crazy, right? Yeah. To be sitting in that first board of governors meeting and Because I had no, you know, when I left the NHL, I was there for 9 years. I felt like we did a lot, accomplished a lot, had a really great time there, loved it. I had never played hockey as a kid. I grew up in Jackson Heights, right? Like, they had roller hockey, but those, you know, those kids were crazy. And I was playing football, you know, during that window. So, but I really grew to really love the sport and the people in it. When I left, it was really just because, you know, at that point in my life, I wanted to go do something else. You know, I was the early 50s. I wanted to do something else. So I had no expectations to come back. It wasn't a negative thing. I just didn't think much about it. And so when I came back, it was good to see how far the league has come in many, many, many ways, right? In terms of the game and the business and everything else. It was ironic to see some of the same, you know, I'm like, we're still talking about this, you know, there was a little bit of that, but that room, much as it did during my time at the NFL, I mean, that room changes a lot and has changed a lot. So, you know, you look at the quality and the ownership across all the leagues, you know, these are really, these are not sort of traditional families who have been in the sport forever and, you know, and are sort of caretakers. I mean, these are, you know, private equity, hedge fund, you know, titans who are used to driving towards, you know, a very successful business model, big returns, franchise value increases. So I think there's a lot more talent in the room across all the leagues. And I think the quality of the business executives has gotten significantly better, right? I mean, the team business, unlike the league, look, the league can be a grind too. Just hockey is a long season. There's no off season. You kind of have to execute what your business plan is while you're writing next year's business plan, right? Because if you wait, you miss a year. So it's a grind, but the team business is really a grind, right? Like you gotta really, you know, just state of, you know, so many entertainment options, the state of, you know, nobody's really buying full season tickets anymore, right? You're competing every game to fill the building. It's which goes back to the product. You need to have a product that really resonates and connects with the fan base and a phenomenal experience. So it was amazing. I you know, Gary has been an incredible leader for the NHL overall. And it was interesting for me to see, I guess, the 10 years that I was away. You know, he still is in charge and running the show, and the business gets better and better. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I know he hasn't talked a lot about transition. I know other people have talked about transition. So it'll be interesting to see how the league ultimately, I don't know if it's coming soon or not, but ultimately you got to think about succession and a transition away from a leader who's been, you know, he's one of the longest serving, if not the longest serving commissioners in all sports, right? So that's a big transition.
What do you admire most about him?
He's very, Gary is very true to who he is. I mean, he's obviously incredibly intelligent. He's a great lawyer. But he's not just a lawyer, right? Like he's got all that experience that he had at the NBA, which was explosive growth, right? During that time. And, you know, also a seminal leader in David Stern, right? Who is, you know, his mentor. And I think he's had a lot, you know, there's just been a lot to do at the NHL, right? And so he's a hardworking guy. He's a family guy. He's a loyal guy. He takes care of his people and he takes care of his ownership group. He's very happy and considers it to be almost like a badge of honor, part of the job, you know, to take all the arrows that might be shot, you know, at the sport. He's just a good man. I think that's what I really liked. To me, he was, and we were doing a lot, you know, John, I felt like we were doing a lot at the time on our side of the business. He was like a big brother. You know, I have a brother. He's a younger brother, but it was like having a big brother. You know, you could go to Gary, you could talk about the business. You could talk about your personal life. You could talk about anything. And he's just a good man.
Well, when he leads that
ownership group in a way that is impressive, right? Like you're talking about 32 billionaires, probably more than 32 billionaires in the league, you know, who, they're billionaires for a reason, right? They're pretty good at what they do. They understand how to build a business and yet they have bought into Gary's leadership.
How does he do that?
Like, not easy.
How does he manage that?
I mean, I think he manages it. I think he's got a lot of tricks. Look, he's the hardest working guy there is, right? The guy travels like a maniac. He gets into the market. He's not a dilettante commissioner, right? Like he gets his hands dirty. He goes to every arena. He sits in the stands, right? He stays for the whole game, right? He is who he is. He also does the hard things. That maybe people don't want to do. So he'll be the first guy to call an owner when they're, you know, the morning after they're knocked out of the Stanley Cup playoffs. He's the first call that they get, you know, like, so he does the hard things. And because he does the hard things, you know, he sees the opportunities and he has the confidence and the affection of a lot of the ownership group. So, you know, and I think over time, I've seen him become, you know, during my time there, he's become more, the structure of the league has changed. He's using committees more. So ownership has more of a say in what's going on. But there's no doubt about he is the leader for the NHL.
Let's be honest. He's mellowed. But he has...
I guess people said that even when I got there, they were like, "You're lucky, you know. He's letting you do things that he wouldn't let anybody else do." I'm like,
he did let you do things. I mean, I was going to say this anyway, but every time you watch an outdoor game, you must smile.
Well, look, I mean, there's so many.
There's a certain point where somebody said we should be doing an outdoor game, and you actually, you know, to take your old football vernacular, you put the ball across the goal line. You did it. We didn't do it. You did it.
Look, we put a team together that really executed it, and we came up with outdoor hockey, not a new concept. That's the way everybody starts out, right? They all learn to play on frozen ponds and lakes and everything else. And LaForge, you know, I talked to him a lot. And, you know, I kept seeing all the photos of, you know, the Canadians and the,
that's Pat LaForge, the
frozen breath. Yeah, Pat LaForge, who, by the way, was a great marketer, right? He was with Molson for a long time, right? The beer, the brewery. Yes, sir. And so, you know, he put it together and I saw the photos and I must have missed it, you know, during my days maybe at the NFL. And I called him and I said, "Tell me about this." And he told me about it. And he told me how great it was. And he told me about the alumni game, which probably was even bigger than the NHL game. And it just, you know, and the weather, which was incredible. But what he said is nobody will ever do it again because we lost $4 million. And so that's really, and, you know, and the, you know, so that was the trick, right? To come up with an economic model that would be sustainable so that this could be not just a one-off, but you could actually, you can do as many as the league has done since then. But the other guy, you know, like I know, you know, I get a lot of credit, John Miller, you know, a lot of people get a lot of credit, Dan Craig, a lot of people get a lot of credit for it. But at the end of the day, Gary was the guy who greenlit it, right? Like Gary, we laid out a plan, which didn't show we were going to lose $4 million, but it didn't show we were going to make $4 million either. And nobody knew that you could sell out, you know, Ralph Wilson Stadium, you know, 80,000 plus for a hockey game on January 1st, right? Like nobody knew it. So Gary greenlit that. And then he stayed with it because there were so many issues that you just didn't even imagine at the time. A lot of them on the operations side, which is why we had guys like Don Renzulli who had run Super Bowls working hand in hand with Dan Craig and Coley's hockey ops staff. But on the hockey side, like, you know, there was a whole list of questions that started coming out. Like, what if the weather turns and we can't play a whole game? What's an official game? Like, we're not baseball, you know, like we don't have those kind of rules. And it was kind of fascinating. And, you know, look, I mean, that's why Gary is so good, because he was in every single one of those meetings. Right. And he drills down into those kind of operational issues that are critical. Right. You have to be able to have those kind of answers. And he's got a great staff. He built a great staff, right? Coley's great. Bill's great, right? He's got a great staff.
Did you hint at an outdoor game at Belmont?
No, it was going to, after we saw one at the NASCAR track, I mean, why not?
I mean, look, I don't, you know, there's always the questions of where you can make the biggest impact and get the most people and what also can be iconic. So yeah, the NYRA guys, New York Racing Association guys who own Belmont Raceway, we'd love to see a game there, and they're great partners to us. And so we'd obviously be supportive. But we're going to have to get to work with the league office on an economic model that would justify doing it at Belmont as opposed to, you know, Yankee Stadium or MetLife or City Field or one of the other big.
I don't think we realize how big a horse race track is. How big it is.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, there's an infield, but the infield's miles from everything.
It's going to be, you know, so we're working with a bunch of guys to produce a music festival. And so the first thing is they come out to the, you know, they come out, they come into the arena, they stand on the Heineken Terrace, which overlooks basically that part of the campus. And there, it's amazing how much property is there. I mean, literally, I think it's second only to, in terms of like green space, it's second only to Central Park in New York City in terms of space. So it's unbelievable. And, you know, for decades, it was basically just horse racing and parking lots, right? And so now you got a village, you got an arena, and now you got a reconfigured raceway. So music festivals, food and wine festivals, those kind of things are easy to see how it could really be an incredible experience out there. Baseball games and hockey games, we got a little work to do. But we'll figure it out.
Realistic, though?
Look, I mean, they're playing two games in Florida, right, this year. So I think anything is realistic, whether it gets done and whether it gets done, you know, over a 5 year, you know, the next 5 years. I don't, you know, that'll be the hard part. We got to put a business plan together. Look, yeah, I'm
curious.
You know, the outdoor game, the trick of the outdoor games, and John, like we would debate this a lot. You know, because then it was like, you know, there was clearly, even when we did one of them, there was like one side of the group that was like, we should only do one, you know, that, you know, not even that you had to do it every year, just that's it. And then there was another side of the group who was like, let's do one every week, you know, like that'll be the NBC at the time, right? Let's do it every week. The amazing thing still to me is that it, in that market, and when you see that fan base for that event, it's as good as anything. It's a Super Bowl. It's as good as anything, and they embrace it. And so that's what we're here to do, right? Like if from a hockey standpoint, it's a legitimate game, right? The conditions are great, and you can say it's not just some like marketing stunt. It's actually an NHL regular season game worth points in the standings. Then, you know, connecting with the fans and giving them almost like a generational opportunity to connect with their friends and family. I mean, it's great. We should do more and more of that.
And actually, to your point about the, you know, the driver of hockey being at the club level, I was with Larry Quinn not too long ago, and the Buffalo Sabres and Larry Quinn were a huge part of what made Ralph Hilton so successful.
And by the way, Larry was like one of the guys who was probing about all those questions, you know?
Right.
And Larry was the guy who, you know, like, I mean, silly things, but I mean, it's like his operational brilliance, like the shovel, right? Shoveling, sure. You know, cleaning the ice. That was Larry. It started in Buffalo. I remember him talking about it. I mean, look, that first Winter Classic, that was not a no-brainer, right? It was very difficult to get an NHL team to agree to do it. And then it was very difficult to get, you know, find a venue, right? I mean, the Buffalo Bills, I mean, you say Buffalo, you know, the market and you know how great it was, you know, and the Sabres were doing a really great job at that time. They were really competitive. Larry was in the community. They were doing some really innovative things. But the Buffalo Bills could have been in the playoffs, you know, like it was January 1st.
Yeah, this was before Terry owned both teams, right? So,
right. This was, exactly. I mean, this was, yeah. It was Russ. The other guy, Larry Quinn, was huge. Russ Brandon, who is president of the Buffalo Bills, he was huge. He was a buddy, and he just loved it. Like he said, this is going to be great for Buffalo. And you know, the Penguins, who, you know, were like one of the star teams at the time in Morehouse, you know, like once we settled on Buffalo, it was really Pittsburgh agreeing to play up there in the first one that made it, you know, that made NBC go, okay, you know what? This could be huge, right? Because they were thinking it was going to be the Bruins and the Rangers at the old Yankee Stadium, and they were stuck on that, right? So, no, it's going to be Buffalo and on January 1st. I remember having Buffalo wings in the Adams Mark Hotel on New Year's Eve. That was our New Year's Eve. I was sitting there with Bill Daly and having a beer.
I think I was two tables over from you, so it's not. Yeah. It wasn't a bad place.
There was nowhere else to go.
No,
everybody was in there. It's a place to be.
Wrap it up this way: expectations for your New York Islanders this year, going through the transition.
Well, I think there were a lot of people in the building, you know, who felt like last year would have been a playoff year, right? Except for injuries and how that impacted the team. That view was sort of validated by, you know, going through the GM search, right? Like you talk to a lot of people. And you're hearing the same view. Maybe it's what we wanted to hear, but there were no requirements. It was kind of a blank canvas. How do you see this?
Nobody's coming in saying we got to tear this down.
Yeah. So like, you know, we had all these incredible building blocks that were right there, you know? And then you meet Matthew and then you spend some time with Patrick Roy, right? And you realize, you know, yeah, this could be it. So, yeah, I mean, I know for certain their point of view is that this is a playoff team. And then when you're in the playoffs, as you guys know better than anybody, anything can happen, right? I think in terms of getting to a level where you can say that this is a legitimate Stanley Cup contender every year, you know, maybe we got a little bit of work to do there. Maybe it'll come quicker than we expect, but for sure, I think people are going into this thinking we should be, this is a playoff team. This is a playoff roster.
Draft lottery set, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't even mention Matthew Schaefer. We didn't even mention Matthew Schaefer, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, if Matthew Darche's career kind of sets up with the same kind of luck that he had in the draft lottery coming in as a first-time GM. I mean, he certainly, you know, made some good moves. But, yeah, Matthew Schaefer is unbelievable. But so were a lot of the other picks that, you know, he had in the first round, right? Those guys at rookie camp looked great, along with Kalen Ritchie and some of the other guys, Isaiah George and some of the other guys that are already in the farm system.
Right.
So, you know, Matthew made a point, Rocky Thompson, you know, at Bridgeport, in terms of, you know, really looking at the Bridgeport team, the AHL team, as a development tool and emphasizing that. Not to say that hasn't been the case, but I think Matthew really wants to change the focus of the AHL team, which I think would be great for the organization. And I think the pipeline is really good. So,
boy, you sound like a hockey guy. Unbelievable.
Well, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you got to baffle them with BS, right, John? We've made a career on that one.
Did you ever give it back to Shannon when you were at the league?
Oh, of course he did. Of course he did.
Listen, John, you know, John was one of those guys like having, you know, look, I do believe in the guys in the arena. I've worked with, you know, I worked with Steve Sable. I worked with Paul Tagliabue. I worked with Roger Goodell. I was in the room, you know, when Jerry Jones and Bob Kraft were coming into the league. I was there when Wellington Mara would get up to the mic. Like, I love that stuff. And, you know, frankly, when John was at the league, it was like one of those, you know, it was one of those sort of jewels. Like Gary told me about John and told me about why he had hired John, you know. And then I really got, then I got to know John. And then I looked sort of and understood John's career and everything that he has done. And I'm like, wow, you know, like, and that was an example of Gary, right? Like, John, the fact that, like, you probably never would have saw yourself at the league office, right? You were running Hockey Night in Canada. Like, you were the Dick Ebersol.
I was with the Maple Leafs at that point and didn't ever think I'd be going and commuting to New York, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, you're focused in elevating not just the national broadcast, but also all the club, the RSN wow. broadcast. That's huge. I mean, that's the biggest marketing platform we have. And
that was
Gary put John in
that's
charge.
That's a long story, but that was a tough sell for a lot of people. Like, why are we worrying about 200 broadcasts and we got 1,000 that we're not doing very well?
Yeah, no, and that's the. You know, that is just to go back to, you know, league versus club. I mean, I had it drilled into me from the NFL owners, right? Like we work for and from guys like Roger, you know, we at the league, we work for the clubs. And, you know, I think that was kind of what I tried to bring to the NHL. And that was, you know, John's position and influence at the league was a good example of Gary sort of recognizing that as well, right? Like the core business, the total revenues of the league, majority of it is coming from the clubs, right? Mm-hmm. Come from the gate receipts, come from the RSNs, coming from, you know, what the fans are spending in the buildings.
We've gotten deeper into this.
Do we get a solo stove for doing this interview?
We got a few in the garage. If you'd like them, I can send them up there.
There you go. Well, Darren doesn't need a solo stove in Vegas, but I need a solo
in Vegas.
I have one, and it's the greatest thing in the winter because it gets down to close to 0-32 during the winter. It's beautiful for your small backyards here. So I know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. Even in the summer night, you get the old s'mores out and
beautiful.
Kids love it. Get a stogie.
You gave the good plug to Heineken, so I figured we got to do a good plug for Solo Stove too. So.
Thank you, John. Thank you. How do you like Vegas, Darren? I mean, you've been there for what, 5 years now?
Yeah, just completed sixth season, and it's amazing. And like you, I came from the national side, though, and went to the club, and you were at the league and went to the club. Totally different experience, and I learned so much, and it's unique, and I love it. Having skin in the game is so much fun.
Yeah, that is it, right? Skin in the game. Have skin in the game.
No,
just being able to root.
You can't. You got to be able to manage the losses. The wins are easy. You just got to manage the losses. That's the thing.
And we're fortunate that way that we got a lot of wins here.
Yeah, I know. But then when you miss the playoffs, you whine too much. Okay.
You know, we've gotten deep into this, but
injuries,
and that was legit. John, will you come back, John Collins? Because there's still I've got my head's. Swirling here with things to talk to you about. Can we get you back on at some point?
I do whatever Shannon tells me to do. Okay. It's worked for me so far.
We'll see you in an hour. Thanks for this, buddy.
Thanks, Darren. Thanks, John.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The discussion about UBS Arena, the space of that facility, whether you're outside the dressing rooms and that hallway, the hallway to the ice, the loading dock, the press box.
They had the land. That's the big difference. You know, when you look at other arenas, you look at in Vancouver, you look in Toronto, they were trying to put a full arena on a postage stamp in both of those places. So there isn't a lot of usable space. Edmonton has usable space.
Seattle, the concourse. It just feels like you can breathe.
Yeah, it's massive. But again, they when you think about all that usable land out there that, as John said, at some point were probably parking lots, it just makes sense to be able to use it rather than trying to cut down. And it seems like they, between, you know, what Scott Malkin and his group and OVG did, they wanted to do it right. And, by the way, finished it during COVID. Another challenge. Same thing for Seattle, trying to build these arenas during the pandemic.
So outdoor games, one of the biggest parts that has developed through this beautiful experience is what the players wear walking into the facility. Can you imagine the silks on the players as they arrive at Belmont?
Can you imagine some of those guys wearing jockey outfits? Seriously.
Yes. Well, that's the obvious thing. Now I can't wait for it to happen just for that.
They'd all be Captain Highliner guys. Wouldn't you be Islander fishermen, just like the old logo that was on the front of the sweaters?
I'm never going back there, ever. I don't care
again
how many years it is. I don't want to see that logo again.
As we talked about. Tumultuous history.
Tumultuous. So you're going to get a dog?
Yes, sir. Going to get a dog today.
What are you getting?
We're getting a West.
We love our dogs.
We do. And we missed not having dogs, so we're going to get a new West Highland Terrier. And it is in our married life, my lovely wife, Mickey, and I, it is our 9th pet. In the 38 years, 9th pet in 38 years. So what are we going to call it?
What are you going to call it?
Well, number 9.
Have you decided?
Yeah, number 9. Who's number 9?
Gordy.
Gordy's the name.
Wow. Not Gordon?
Not Gordon. Formal?
Is Gordon the legal name and then Gordy's the nickname?
No, it's Gordy.
No.
And, and just for the record... because everybody's going to think I'm lying. It was not my idea.
Well, I speak from experience. You're going to be crusty for the next little bit.
We've been through it. Don't worry.
It doesn't matter. You're still crusty. Good luck with it. Can't wait to see Gordy in person next time we record the podcast.
Gordy might show up. You never know.
Yeah. Oh, we'll hear Gordy, I'm sure. Thanks to John Collins. Thanks to Human Clarity for joining us. And thanks to you. Leave us a rating. Please give us your feedback on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.